call our Board of Regents January committee meetings to order. I apologize up front for a lengthy agenda. We will try to be as efficient as we can while at the same time allowing for proper discussion of important items as the agenda proceeds. I want to welcome everybody here. We have a full room today, which is great. There needs to be and should be a lot of interest in higher education in these times. It's hard to believe that it's been a year. A year ago at this meeting, we introduced our preferred candidate for new president, and Vital has issued by quickly. We'll welcome Regent Henson to the meeting.
I didn't get a speeding
So in addition to a new president this year, we have a couple of newer members, one of whom has already been sworn in. The other will be here in just a few minutes. I think we're seeing this university evolve. Certainly this board is evolving with the times, and our committee structure that we have, which we're having meetings for today, has been in this format for many years. For better or worse, we have a board of 11 members, and there are many boards that are bigger than that. There are some that are smaller. I happen to think this is a good number, not too big nor too small. And during the course of the committee meetings, only the members on those particular committees will be able to vote. But because of the size of our board being as small as it is, it affords the opportunity for all members to enter into the discussion phase. And, of course, when we have our regular meeting, they will be able to vote. Some of our business is rather routine and mundane. Others is more critical to the future direction and success of this university, and it's my hope and intention that most of our meeting time can be spent with meaningful dialogue and substantive discussion about those matters. So with those opening remarks, our first order of business is to swear in our new regent, Dr. Klaus Ernst. And Klaus, I'll meet you right up there. Okay. We'll... So the office is one that all officials in the state of Kentucky take, and so I'm going to ask you to raise your right hand. And do you solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the Commonwealth and be faithful and true to the Commonwealth of Kentucky so long as you continue a citizen thereof, and that you will faithfully execute to the best of your ability the office of member of the Board of Regents of Western Kentucky University according to law? Do you further solemnly swear that since the adoption of the present Constitution, you, being a citizen of the state, have not fought a duel with deadly weapons within the state nor out of it, nor have you sent or accepted a challenge to fight a duel with deadly weapons, nor have you acted as a second in carrying a challenge, nor aided or assisted any person thus offending, so help you God?
I do.
Very good. Tradition was established, I think, under Dr. Ransel's presidency that every regent be awarded a pin. And, these are distinctive pins that each regent can wear proudly, and it signifies that you have willingly, voluntarily accepted the duty and the privilege of serving on this Board of Trustees, and in doing so will maintain and keep the duty of loyalty and the duty of care in carrying out
the functions of this board.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very good.
Thank you. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
With that, we will go to our committee agendas, and first on the agenda today is our Finance and Budget Committee. And I'll turn that over to the chairman.
Thank you, Johnson. Thank you, Phil. We have here today all members of the committee, Mr. Ridley, Mr. Porter, and certainly myself. So I'll go to the agenda, as is our procedure. Each item will be separate. We'll take a motion in a second, and then proceed on each item to a discussion and presentation. Presentation slash discussion. So the first item is acceptance of the auditor's report and financial statements for fiscal year ending June 30, 2017. On page 1 and 2 of your report. Do I have a motion on that?
So moved.
Mr. Bigden, second. Mr. Porter, and presentation, discussion.
Yes, we have Hugo partner with Carl Horwood, and Mr. Chair, if it's fine with you, this presentation will cover the first two agenda items. The technicality, do you need to get a motion on the second one, since he's going to.
I thought we'd take them all separately. FB one and two.
Okay. His presentation, I'm going to turn it over. It will cover both. So
okay.
Just understand that the discussion. We can answer questions after you you take action.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Capps. Apparently, the auditor's presentation will cover both items. Should we go ahead and make a motion on the second one? Sir?
Could have a motion to include both of them, or you could have a motion to include them separately.
Okay. Well, from the committee, do I hear a motion maybe to include approval FB1 and FB2?
Okay. So.
Ready? Ready? Do I hear a second?
Second.
Oh, okay. All right, so we have both motions.
Thank you. You've got me dotting my I's and crossing my T's on protocols. I'm working with you. So, Mr. Hugo.
Thank you. Oh, good morning. As Ann said, my name is Pete Hugo. I'm a partner at Crowe Horwath, and I am part of our higher education practice. So we're very happy to work with the university on your annual audit engagement. Thank you for having me here today to give an overview. I've prepared a few overview materials here, but we're happy to answer any questions that you may have related to the audit engagement. I'm going to just go over a few required communications and a review of the financial statements today. As far as an outline of what our engagement covers and the materials that you receive from our firm, first is our opinion on audit report of the university's financial statements. The single audit report or uniform guidance, which is required because of the level of federal grant expenditures that you have within the fiscal year. We also issue separate audit reports for the radio and TV stations, as that is required by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So that is part. That is part of the university's audit, but also standalone audit reports that we issue separately. There are some required communications that we make to the group that has governance over the audit process. So that is this committee, and these are part of our comments today. If we have any management recommendations, we were required to communicate those. And we also have a couple of specific Kentucky requirements. House Bill 622 letter and the Kentucky Lease Law Compliance Report contain some state-required compliance testing that we need to make about some of your controls and processes and your compliance with any significant new leases that you enter into within the year. So all of those items are in your materials and what we're covering today. We've completed all of those pieces of the engagement for the 2017 fiscal year end. The NCAA agreed upon procedures engagement is also an additional part of this engagement that is due in January. That was completed timely and will be covered at your next meeting as well. So several different pieces of what we work with your management to prepare. As far as a brief audit overview, we conduct multiple stages of the audit engagement, preliminary work. We have an on-site planning meeting with key members of management. We also have a separate visit where we typically look at student financial aid compliance and other federal grant compliance, and then our year-end field work. Throughout that involves an assessment of the internal control environment where we rotate internal control tests and observations that we make and focus on key risk areas. And we do obtain input from this committee on the beginning stages of the audit on any risks or concerns that you may have and want us to pay attention to. So we appreciate your input and involvement on that. The single audit is, the federal audit that's required because of the federal grant funds that you have. We're required to select major programs according to the guidance as to what we test in detail. And that involved two major programs this year, a student financial aid cluster and the TRIO programs. So in those testing elements, we're required to look at individual student files on a sampling basis, the aid they were awarded, the usage of grant funds to verify that it's in compliance with the restrictions. So that involves not only your accounting department, but grants and student financial aid and many others. After that, we complete the audit procedures and draft the reports, meet with management to review all the reports in draft form, and then finalize them that you're receiving today. At a high level, we did provide a clean or unmodified opinion on the financial statements, which means that in our opinion, the financial statements fairly present the financial position and activities of the university for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2017. So that's a good report that you want to receive like you've received in prior years. Quick note here at the bottom, no new GASB pronouncements were effective this year. Again, GASB is the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, and that's the group that provides the accounting requirements that are part of your financial statements. There was a significant change in recent years that you may recall discussing with GASB 68 for pensions, but I just want to point out there were no new items this year that significantly changed your financial statements. And I definitely want to point out that we did have outstanding cooperation from everyone in management. The finance team was very transparent with us and responsive in everything that we needed, as well as those who are involved in the NCAA and radio and television audits, and we appreciate that very much. Excuse me, it's not advancing.
Yeah. Working on it.
Okay. Well, the next slide provides a financial statement overview because I wanted to provide just a few summary level comments on the financial statements. Obviously, your audited financial statements are a very lengthy document with a lot of required footnote disclosures and details within it. The financial statements do include the university, the research foundation, which is a blended component unit, meaning it's shown as part of the university's numbers. And there are three other entities that are presented, what's called discretely presented. So you'll see separate pages for each of their statements of net position and statement of changes. And that's the WKU Foundation, Student Life Foundation, and College Heights Foundations. Okay, thank you. And so those three entities are audited by other auditors who provide their audit reports to us. We rely upon those in issuing your overall university-level opinion. Our firm audits the university and the WKU Research Foundation. Here at the bottom of the page is a summary of some of the key numbers from your statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position at the university level. That's just the GASB terminology for your income statement. So you can see here your operating revenues and expenses, your non-operating activities, which are primarily grants, appropriations, things of that nature, capital contributions and other to show your overall change in your net position for the year. So this is comparing 2016 and 2017 to each other. And there is much more detail in the actual financial statements. These are just the subtotals that are most useful.
Stop for just a second. When you just look at this slide, I think it would be obvious to say, wait a minute, what happened between 16 and 17? Correct me if I'm wrong, the biggest is the additional adjustments related to pension liability.
Yes, and I have a slide on
we'll get to that, but I think when you see that bottom line, your first reaction is, oh, we had a bad year. The pension liability is complex, and it does impact the financial statements significantly.
John just asked me, and I agree with this, that members of the committee may have questions as you go along. So okay, just
yes,
let's stop right here.
So,
John, go ahead.
Yeah, and this may be directed to Ann. When we look at that, our operating loss is down $30 million in 1 year, and the decrease in net position is almost $14 million. Is there any explanation in that?
the capital contributions line at the bottom flows in through that as well. And so since you had $16 million of capital contribution increase this year, that rolls into the change in net position total.
The capital contribution is likely the science complex project from the state. Yes? Looking around for thumbs up.
So is that paid in one lump sum, or does that come from the state in multiple payments throughout the construction phase?
It's multiple payments. It's as we expend, we can draw down from the state. We submit some staff in accounting that will submit a request to the state as we expend, and they can pull down after they show that funds have been expended.
Basically, it's a one-time issue in relationship to the state provided money for the science complex. Thank you.
Can I ask a question, even my fellow committee member? So when I looked at your report the prior year, which is not on there, we also have a decrease in net position. Is this a trend we sort of actually could sustain in the long run?
The decrease in net position was $4.4 million last year, $18.7 million this year. Certainly you can't have decreases in net position forever. To supplement what Ann said, the pension is a major driving factor of this. So if you look at cash flow, the pension liability is a long-term liability that represents your share of the state's unfunded pension status, or KTRS and KERS. That's not an immediate cash flow need, but it does flow through your statement of activity. So it makes this look worse than it really is when that hits. But certainly, if you see a trend of continuing decreases in that position, that's a concern.
What's the amount of pension?
Remember the impact this year?
The additional expense that we had to record this year that were numbers that were provided by the state of Kentucky to help us increase our liability to show what the KTRS and KERS plan showed our liability was an additional just over $20 million. So really, outside of that, if we remove that $20 million additional expense, if we had eliminated that, we would have actually had a net profit of about $1.4 million this year. So there were a lot of good things that happened. It's been overshadowed by that pension issue that we're all dealing with.
And all the other schools and governmental entities in the state that participate in the plan are experiencing a similar thing. There were some changes in some of the assumptions that the actuarial calculations use, KTRS and KERS, that really increased the liability this year. One would hope that if investment returns continue at the rate they have been in recent months, the next round of this, it will shorten that gap a little bit, but we won't know that for sure until we receive the next report.
So that was also the issue that we had last year when we were discussing the negative flow of the TV, radio,
yes, you'll see that in all three.
Because it was pulling down the capital reserve based on the negative number when we had the asset sitting there, but showing the negative side of the pension.
Yeah, since the radio, so since, for example, radio and TV have employees, the liability follows the salary expense, so it does get allocated even down to that level.
So the lesson and the takeaway is this pension issue is not just in the newspaper. This is an actual results of what happens to our financial statements,
yes,
which we need to recognize. When people look at these negative numbers, this does not mean that WKU is doing a bad job. It's meaning that we're being forced to take care of an issue that basically was not ours in the making.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Okay. This graph shows a comparison of your statement of net position or your balance sheet for the 2 years. The first set is the assets and deferred outflows, similar to assets. Liabilities and deferred inflows on the next column, and then your net position. So you can see from 2016 to 17, your assets and liabilities both increased. Your liabilities increased again. Has a lot to do with the pension was contributing to that. There are several other factors that, again, this is summary level. If you look at these statements in detail, and the management discussion and analysis that leads off the audit report is a very useful portion of the report that management's prepared to provide the reader with key indications of what happened during the year. But this is visually showing you a summary of your statement of net position. And I did want to spend here briefly one slide on the net pension liability, since that is such a large piece of your liabilities. So we mentioned here your total liabilities and deferred outflows were $779 million. The portion that relates to your proportionate share of the state pension is $543 million of that. So you can see it's a significant number. This was a GASB statement that required you to put each participant's share of the unfunded pension liability onto your financial statements. That was effective a couple of years ago, and so that is when this liability first began showing up. The pieces I've listed here in the middle of how it breaks down between KTRS and KERS, and the liability is an estimate based on several assumptions about everything from discount rate, rate of return, et cetera. So there are actuarial assumptions. And this valuation is provided to your management by the plans themselves. They have audited financial statements prepared that are provided to you for review and for calculation of this number. So we do a significant amount of testing and work related to this to understand the assumptions that go into it, and management's heavily involved in analyzing this information when it does arrive. You know, we won't know what the impact of the next fiscal year will look like until probably after the end of this fiscal year when the report starts coming in. But again, this year it makes up $543 million of your liabilities. I did want to point out that next year there is another new GASB statement, number 75, that is going to have a similar impact as 68, but in relation to OPEB plans. So other than pension employee benefits, health care primarily. So to the extent that any entities are involved in a statewide, for example, OPEB plan, if it's underfunded, that liability will come onto your balance sheet, just like you have said. I don't know the potential of what that impact may be at this point. That'll be something that we're going to be waiting to see reporting on. But just wanted to give you the information that all governmental entities are going to be going through this as well, to the extent they're part of a plan that provides health care benefits to retirees.
Then how would that impact how WKU does their health care? If we are underfunded, would that show up under that area?
No, we're talking about post-retirement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not our current health care for our employees.
So if the plan that you're in has its actuarial calculation of liabilities and it's underfunded, it would be a similar concept.
I would suggest that you, instead of this being footnote at the end of your report, that you lead off this slide right here so that it gives us all a remembrance of exactly what we deal with. Our own numbers.
Certainly. And when we review the next year's audit report with that information, we can certainly do that. This slide covers a statement of auditing standards 114, which is an auditing standard that requires us to communicate certain things to the group that oversees the audit process. We are engaged by and report to this committee on behalf of the board, and we want to make sure that we have any open communications with you that you'd like to have. So Our communications here, I'll summarize quickly, nothing of major concern here. Our responsibility in the engagement is to provide an opinion on the financial statements that are management's responsibility to prepare, and your management does prepare and draft the financial statements, and we've provided our opinion. Our responsibility under government auditing standards would be to disclose to you if we noted any instance of material noncompliance with federal rules and regulations. We did not note any such items. If there were any changes in your accounting policies or management's estimates in the financials, we would need to disclose to you the nature of those items, and management did not make any changes to significant accounting policies this year, and as I mentioned previously, there were no new pronouncements that had an impact on your financial statements. The last point on this slide, if we had any concerns about the qualitative aspects of your accounting practices, this would include, for example, if you had policies that we felt were aggressive or inappropriate, or if management was selectively posting adjustments we provided, we would need to tell you about those qualitative factors. There were no items to disclose there. And then on the remainder of these, if we had any material audit adjustments that were posted as a result of our procedures, we would need to inform you of that, and there were no such items. This would be an instance where we noted an error or a discrepancy in our auditing procedures that resulted in a material adjustment to the financials, and there were none of that nature. Waived adjustments are items that are below a materiality that we determine in the planning stages that we think has a material impact to a user of your financial statements. Items below that level, we do not require management to post, and those are oftentimes referred to as past adjustments. There was one item this year related to the calculation of pension expense. And this is coming from the KT and KERS reports. There was a clarification of some of the breakdown of contributions between pension and insurance. that would have had a minor effect on the prior year's financial statements. And so that was not restated in the prior year because it was, again, not a material amount. It's therefore a waived adjustment that's running through this year. And under other communications is where we tell you of any of the items noted here. For example, if there's other information in documents containing the audited financial statements. So what we need to inform you of here is that the management discussion and analysis and some of the pension schedules that are in the report are marked unaudited. Those are prepared by management to provide some explanation related to the financials and compare it to the financials to see that it is reasonable in comparison, but it is not an audited document. So that's the management discussion analysis is prepared by your management. The rest of these, we would tell you if we had any significant difficulties during the audit, disagreements with management, et cetera. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we had no such items. Your management's very transparent with us. They contact us with any questions throughout the year. It's not just an audit time. That really helps us be able to understand what is happening and to address those factors throughout the year instead of waiting until just the audit. And it's a very good thing that makes the audit process go smoothly. No other findings or concerns that we need to communicate to you. The other auditing standard that we need to communicate under is Statement of Auditing Standards 115, which relates to management letter comments. And this standard provides us with these categories that we can assign any of our observations to. So this is internal control observations, findings, or discrepancies with some of your grant funds. Material weakness and significant deficiency are the most severe. These are areas where we believe there's an internal control breakdown that could allow a material error to occur in your financials and not be detected by your internal controls. Those are required to be communicated to the board in the form of a written management letter. We did not have any items that we felt were at that level. Therefore, we did not issue a written management letter. A deficiency and best practice are the other categories, and those are really more minimum level types of comments that are perhaps we're recommending a more clear documentation process or some sort of written policy. We did not, again, issue the written management letter. We had a few of the items at those minimum levels, just observations as we go through that we discuss with management while we're on site during the audit. Perhaps you could document this policy a little more clearly, comparing best practices that we see at other institutions we work with. And any of those items have been discussed with management, that there was nothing that is at the level of severity that we felt needs to be in a written management. And lastly, some of the other reports that we've issued to date related to WKU or WKYU TV and FM. Those reports were issued in December for the fiscal year of June 3, 2017, as required by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They are included as part of a required annual financial report that your management files with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that we need to certify, and we've already completed that. These were unmodified or clean opinions as well. And again, they are part of the university's activities and report, but these are just standalone reports only for the radio and TV stations. And I've summarized here at the bottom some of the key financial information for you. The first four lines represent the TV. The bottom four represent the radio station, showing your assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses for the two fiscal years for comparison purposes. And I believe those full reports are included in your materials. So that completes the audit reports. Again, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about the process of the report.
Let me start with committee members first. Question, comment before we open it up. John?
The question on the enrollment report that's on page 4. And so the question I had is, where are the dual credit students in this number?
Management discussion and analysis, yes.
Are you looking at the audit overview?
I'm looking at the main booklet.
They are not separately identified. They are in the number, as we are allowed to count them as our students.
Okay.
So the 20,271 includes students.
Okay, I have two comments on this. I'm not sure how much the rest of you are aware that dual credit students don't bring really any revenue to the university. And I believe that it would be appropriate to break those out because it gives a very misleading picture. If the headcount remains roughly constant, but the dual credit students take up an ever larger share. Okay.
I believe we have had that data recently.
maybe at our last meeting.
Okay.
We'll break them out starting this year.
Out there somewhere, mm-hmm. And the board is very aware that the dual credit population is does not make it much revenue.
The total undergraduate headcount is 2,500 dual credits. It's approximately.
Right. And the second follow-up question on this is, I don't quite understand the application number you put in there. So my understanding is that we have a very high acceptance rate, over 90%. So
there's a difference between accepting and enrolling. So
I see. Okay.
So they're admitted. They apply. They are accepted, and then we have to work on the yield to come in the actual show up.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments?
I'd like to make a comment. First of all, thank you all for your report, and I'm happy that it's a relatively clean report, and I want to commend President Caboni on his ongoing efforts of addressing these rather sobering statistics. I want to put a plug in for the Budget Council, which has been reactivated and has been hard at work. In tandem with a strategic planning process that will hopefully help us address some of these very, very sobering numbers that we've all seen. I think these are times that are going to draw on all the expertise that this board can come up with and help us, and I'm thankful we have people with better financial minds and mathematical skills than I have. And we will take on these challenges in a very proactive manner.
Anything further? Hearing no further.
You should vote separately on those two items.
Say again, I'm sorry.
You probably should vote separately on the two items.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, with that advice, I will do that. There is a motion on the floor for the approval of FD action item number one, and seconded. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. Hearing none, FD action item number one passes unanimously. And now we have a motion on the floor with respect to item number two. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. Hearing none, that motion also passes unanimously. We'll get two birds here with one stone.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Dee, for taking off on us.
Let's take 1 second and recognize the great work that David Brinkley has done for media operations, and we're all grateful to see him here and well and with a good medical report.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, we'll move to action item number three on the Finance and Budget Committee, and that is a motion to approve the 2017-18 operating, or revisions, excuse me, 17-18 operating budget, which appears beginning on page four of your items. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Kenny? Second. David? Ann?
Yes. We have a request for you to approve an increase in the budget, $781,500. It's broken out into two pieces. One is your approval of net assets, we typically call carry forward funds that we've been holding in reserve for capital projects. And the second part is an increase in expenditure authority for revenue that has been brought in or anticipated to be brought in between now and June 30th. The in that order, let me take the $230,000. While the $215,000 in miscellaneous revenue may seem like a lot, there are numerous departments that this impacts. Majority of that $250,000 is related to reimbursements that come in for expenses that have already occurred, including money that comes from the W. Keeper Foundation over to the university to make us whole. The net assets, we do have some capital reserves, and these are three that we do maintain. I think it's good fiscal stewardship to put money back for replacement of vehicles, bus refurbishing. I applaud management in those areas to be able to have money so that it's not declared an emergency and we come back to you just to take down the reserves that we do have. The police reserve related to a capital project that's been ongoing, and if there's any additional questions on that one, I understand there may be. Mr. Kuster can answer those.
And I had a question, assuming that you're going to toss it to Mr. Kuster. In the governor's proposed budget address, they talked about a $300 million maintenance fund available to the universities with a dollar-for-dollar match. I know that's a clear recommendation. Looking at the police renovation, is that an item if it were tabled and postponed until we see if that materializes where we can get dollar-for-dollar matching monies in that project?
It's an excellent question. We'd have to look into that. The actual regulations that pertain to a matching have not been finalized. I am suspecting not, because I think the matching is more likely to be projects that this one is underway in the current biennium. But we obviously would do everything we could to count that. Brian, to what degree is that renovation, preservation of assets, is that what you're doing in your police department?
Yes, it's, you know, obviously the police department currently is in the parking structure one, which is about 50 years old. Okay. And, you know, we've been putting money away for about 4 or 5 years. Originally, there was going to be in the Alumni Square a new police department built, and so when that didn't happen, we started putting this debt asset account so that we could try to do that ourselves. We are in the middle of planning and design. I think we may know more what happens at the state level before the construction would start, and I would look at Brian Russell.
If they do it like they did the prevailing wage, if we had not bid the project out yet, then we very possibly could, if they do this similar process, design is okay, but since we hadn't bid the work out yet, maybe. So if this, and do you think this will be April? When we'll know a little bit more about the details?
So that's a good point. We need to keep that in mind as we proceed with the project, not to impede our ability to match if it becomes a matching opportunity.
How does that impact approval from this committee to allow a revision of the budget? Is that a type of commitment that might taint our ability to seek matching funds?
No, I think it's more of the status of the project.
All we're asking is to move money into the reserve fund. We're not asking to start the project. We're amassing funds to be able to do the project. So without this money, we couldn't do the project. So we haven't bid it yet, and I think that's what Brian's comment was, that probably until it's bid, we made it, we'd have some flexibility possibly.
While we're 100% certain that funds would be available to do this project, you can understand planning, design, and construction has a process that says, let me know where the money is coming from, because I'm not going to start a project and you're going to come back and say, oh, that fund source dried up. So I think this is a little bit of an accounting entry that ensures that that the project does have funds.
I think the other thing to keep in mind is that as we move through the legislative process, we'll get some more clarity on the way in which projects will make it onto or not onto that list. And there are some questions about, is that a legislative decision, will that happen through the Council on Post-Secondary Education? My expectation, hope, would be any projects that we would advance would go through CPE. Certainly anything on which we were expending money or plan to expend money, including this one, is something that we could get on that list. So if we were to do that, the hope would be that it would reduce the cost by 50%. I don't think making the decision today changes that, but we would advocate for any work that we had in progress or planned to do, we try to get the match. All of that based upon the approval of the budget at the end of the session. So we're working on it.
John?
Well, I think the president addressed it. I mean, the bigger picture is to again look forward and to see what is going to be there. We certainly don't want to leave a dollar for dollar match on the table, and we need to have the money in advance if possible. However, one thing is, and maybe some clarity, and Brian or someone might have to do this. I thought that any project that fell under this $300 million had to be already on the capital improvement plan that was submitted to post-secondary education. But that was an advanced construction.
Again, the intent is to address a significant backlog of deferred maintenance and capital renewal needs. I don't know exactly. It's in our secure capital plan. That may be sufficient.
Well, and my point there was is that also we already have an infrastructure. We've been spending about $10 million a year on infrastructure on upgrading. If that's the case, we need to be prepared in advance. If this legislation passed, that's $10 million we've already decided we're going to spend. That's in the plan.
And that's
would be a huge amount of money that we could immediately capitalize on of $10 million. So that would cut our costs by half. So anyway, just that we're aware that we need to be planning in advance.
So that it is clear, based on Freddie's question, is that we are approving a reserve, but we may not proceed until following March or April, at which time we might know what the regulations or the statute says, and then we can adjust accordingly. And if we're entitled to half those funds, we get them back. Is that what I hear everybody say?
Yes.
From the comments, I agree. Yes,
that's I saw you nod.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, that's the strategy.
Is that it, Dan?
Yes.
Okay. Does anybody have any other discussions or comments on any of this? Not hearing any further discussion. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Okay, we move to action item number 4. This is a pretty standard one for us, approval of personnel actions. It begins on page 5 of your material, and then, of course, the attachments to that. Do I have a motion to approve personnel actions?
So moved. Second.
Ready? And then second. Jason? And is there anything that needs to be said?
Just a couple of comments. As you're aware, we implemented a new process that puts extra scrutiny on whether a position can be searched. And you might look at the personnel actions and think, it's not working. But look at the date. The date goes back to August 24th. And in the personnel actions, the one-time compensation is back to September. I'm not sure when we implemented the process, December-ish. October? Okay, that part. But anyway, my point is that a lot of these personnel actions happen prior to our process, but really what you will note by pages, the majority relate to part-time faculty payments and faculty overload and staff that are in fact teaching a course here and there. So that's why the personnel actions seem so lengthy. Any additional
questions or comments from anybody? Hearing none, then I'll ask the vote on the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. Motion passes unanimously. We'll go to the last action item, acceptance of the second quarter statement of revenue and expenditures, which appears beginning on page 6 of the handout. And I will entertain the motion for approval. Jason, motion, second. David Porter, Ken.
Yes, on 6A in the second quarterly report, when we identify student tuition and fees, please understand that this is student billing. We don't operate on a cash basis. So the spring semester, a lot of registrations occurred in the month of December, but not all of them. So it will take to the third quarter for me to be able to see an absolute picture on where we are on student tuition billings. The numbers align where what we have been saying since the fall semester. Our projection is about 3% short budget on tuition that accrues centrally. So therefore, we will be managing a shortfall in the $4 to $5 million range. We have identified a carry forward for the divisions, held it sufficient to ensure that that deficit in tuition will be covered by June 30th. We will not allocate the carry forward back to ensure that we finish in the black. So if anybody has any other questions,
questions from committee at all? Discussion? Anyone else? Okay. Hearing no further discussion, presentation. Ask for a vote on the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. All opposed, like sign. Motion passes unanimously. And that takes us out of our five action items that we wrote to the agenda for the next board meeting. And we now move to the information items, quarterly internal audit report. Jennifer Miller. Thank you, Ann.
Mm-hmm. I'll be back.
I know. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I thought we're having technical difficulties. Okay. Good morning. So since the last time we met, we've been able to issue some audit reports, of course. We've completed some NCAA agreed-upon procedures, and we were able to jumpstart a couple of internal audit 2018 initiatives that I'm really excited to tell you about, but I'll leave that part for last. So this is our dashboard, and as you can hear, there's a lot going on, which means there's a lot going on in the internal audit. Today, we always focus on the completed activities, so that's up there on the top. I mentioned the NCAA agreed-upon procedures. Those are the procedures that we do every year that assist the external auditors in their full report that they do. And then the other three are the actual audit reports that we issued this last quarter. I wanted to show you the rest of the audit plan. Everything on here is part of that. So on this side, it's the summary of our draft reports. Those three things do have draft reports right now. So those are the things that you can kind of look forward to for the next meeting. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about those because those will be issued. Unless, of course, something crazy happens, but those should be the ones that come up. And then at the bottom of that, underneath, is the other projects that are in progress right now. And those projects are anywhere on the audit process spectrum. They can be in the planning stage. We also have a pre-planning stage prior to that, and then, of course, the actual field work testing that goes on with those. And the rest of the audit plan is on the other side of the bottom. So those are the things that we either have kind of started or have not started yet, and those are the upcoming ones that are left over. So this kind of gives you a feel for what the year has looked like or what it's going to look like and where we might end up by the end of the fiscal year, just to kind of also give you a reminder of what's on the actual audit plan and things that we've been working on. So the three audit reports that we issued, just as a reminder, we usually go into detail when we have some high recommendations. And for the three that we have, there were no high recommendations. But I'll give you a brief summary of what we went through. Sorry. 2017 President's Travel and Entertainment. That scope covered the transactions that were for fiscal year ending June 30, 2017. We had two recommendations come out of that, and that's typical for that report. And again, that's just a reminder to say that we do perform that one on an annual basis. The next one would be the change fund analysis audit. I'm going to give you some numbers just to give you some context about what we're looking at. So the first number is 21. That is currently the number of change funds that are out on campus. And if you don't remember, we talked about change funds a while back. Those are just cash funds that are used by different areas or departments on campus to actually make change when they're having sales of goods or services. So it's exactly what it means. We had four recommendations from that, and all of those recommendations were related to basically adding additional controls into the current policies and procedures around the handling of the cash. And the next number I want to give you is $70,000. That's the dollar amount in total for the 21 cash or the change funds. It's not material in the eyes of external auditors or maybe some of you sitting here, but internal audit doesn't look at materiality. We're looking at, of course, the processes and procedures to safeguard those assets. So that's why we do these unannounced cash counts, and we do these throughout the year. This is one of our continuous audits that we do. So we'll go and meet with the custodian of the cash, talk about their reconciliation process, their documentation of that. It's an opportunity for us to have a teaching moment with them if they're not aware of the things that are in the policy. Hopefully they are. But it is still a moment where we can say and reiterate these are your responsibilities as the cash custodian. So again, four recommendations for that, and those were dealing with the policies and procedures around that. The last report that I'll talk about is the procurement card analysis audit. A procurement card is, of course, the university credit card. A number for that is 820. That is the number of cards that were active at one time on campus prior to a change in our third-party service provider. The contract came up. We went through the RFP process. We changed to a different service provider. And the procurement card office, along with our chief financial officer, took that opportunity to kind of rein that in and clean that up. So the next number is 699. That's the current active cards that are on campus. So they're managing that risk of pro cards by decreasing the number that are out there and active. And so that was a decrease of about 15%, which is great. Within this pro card analysis, internal audit was able to get a set of data, all of the transactions for all the pro cards for the year. And we're able to do an overall spend analysis. So this will help us guide the next procurement card analysis so that we can look at different ways of taking samples of the pro cards and different ways to test and understand where we're spending our money, if it seems logical, and who's spending the money. So it will kind of guide the next session of all of these testings of the pro card. We'll continue to do compliance reviews as well, but I think the data analysis will be a big help to maybe spread out our coverage as well. So just as a high-level overview again, I talked really fast through that. So we had three reports. Total 14 is the number of recommendations for all of those reports. Like I said, none of them were high recommendations. They're considered medium or low. And that's based on other compensating controls that we know are in place, based on things that those people may be doing to mitigate that risk. So we kind of go through a discussion about what the priority rating should be. And then 64%, that is the number of, out of 14 recommendations, 64% of them were related to improving our policies and adding additional controls in those documents and implementing them, of course. So these are the initiatives that I was speaking about. This is the fun part because this is more fun for us. We are launching a fraud awareness campaign. And I say we, internal audit is. This is something that we've not done before. We are putting together a face-to-face discussion presentation about fraud awareness. It's focusing on occupational fraud. We talk about the impact that it would have on WKU. We are trying to educate people about the fraud triangle and any red flags that they should be aware of. And also, we, of course, will be advertising the WKU Ethics and Compliance Hotline. I'm not doing these presentations, thank goodness, because I do these enough. So Sarah Reese, our other internal auditor, she's spearheading this campaign, and she's done nothing but good things with this, and I've got very much positive feedback about the two that she's already completed, and we've scheduled two more. So we're hoping that we go through the year and You have a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Fish.
Oh, sorry. We're hoping this leads us to get out on the campus and, of course, create an awareness of things that could be going on and educate everyone about what they might want to look for if there's red flags and who they might want to call if they see something that they're just not sure about.
Jeffrey, let me stop you there and ask a question. On this fraud awareness campaign, I assume it's a voluntary participation from the university, or are we thinking about making it mandatory?
Right now it's voluntary.
And to whom is it directed? I mean, at what level? Does it go as high as the dean level, vice president level, et cetera?
It's anybody that wants us to come and speak. Right now, the two that's been completed were for a group of budget managers that are around campus, and she's also gone to College of Health and Human Services, which was a request from the dean.
But it's your department that's contacted them saying, we have a fraud awareness campaign, or do they?
They contacted us.
It sort of seems to me that the fraud awareness campaign is exceptionally important, and that maybe it ought to be more on a mandatory level, and where you are saying, we're going to come see you and give you this presentation. What's your calendar look like? I don't know. President Caboni, would you?
Yeah, I think using this as a test case to get our feet wet, to make sure that we've got the presentation in the can, and then as we roll through the semester and into next year, thinking about where the places we want to deploy this proactively instead of reactively. Letting folks who are interested in having the presentation be the first out the gate, and then as we move through the organization, checking folks off.
Right? Well, of course, I like that. The voluntary nature of that. Freddie, you got the...
I was just wondering, would it be appropriate to do that presentation at one of our board meetings?
Oh, yeah.
I would love for her to do that. Yes.
Freddie, are you voluntary?
Whatever it takes.
It is a good idea.
And again, so far, she's had really good success with it. They go through and find the fraudster, so it's, you know, there's a little bit of a game to it, but it gets you thinking about, you know, it could be the person sitting next to you that everybody loves, and those are the types of things that it's talking about, and of course the triangle and the red flags, but yeah, I can do that.
If I can, then I guess maybe the next meeting is important. It could be the full board meeting, depending on what the agenda is, but could we discuss that?
You might want to consider whether you want to hold it for your retreat. It might be a good retreat topic.
Right. But you and I can work on putting that on the agenda so that we do that. So that's a formal request.
Thank you. The other thing that we're excited about is something I'm calling chat sessions. And this is Internal Audit's way of growing the enterprise risk management process at the university. It's a way to start integrating risk management into decision-making. So the chat sessions are to be held with kind of, I call it mid-level leadership. So I don't want to label anybody that because I'm not really sure. But it's really a time for me to get to talk to the deans and the department heads and more into the weeds and talk to the people that are closer to the processes and procedures so that they can have an impact on the risk universe and ultimately the audit plan. And we'll still do the risk assessment like we do with the executive teams and also with the finance and budget committee members. But this is a way for us to spread that risk management out to campus and to start having people think about what's their objectives in their own area, what's their strategies, and what decisions are they making. And with those decisions, there's always risk with every decision that you make. So we want to start helping and talking about those things and adding that to our whole universe, our risk universe. So those things are important. The more I read about enterprise risk management, the more that I learn about how it should look or what's the best practice. So it's not really supposed to be a department or a person leading that. It is supposed to be integrated into your everyday decision making. And that's what we want to help do. And that's what we're here for. We're here to help, and we're here to help make decisions and help understand what those risks are.
Do you have a question?
Go ahead, Jordan.
You're not meeting here, I'll come after you.
I can't remember if you've given this information recently. How much hotline activity are you having?
It's not a lot. I think on the agenda item, we've had 22 total calls, and we still have two of those that are in preliminary review. But it's not been a swarm of people calling. And that's kind of where this fraud awareness campaign will help. I think that we've heard that people don't know where to call. They don't know that the hotline is there, even though we've advertised it in the past. But this is more of a push for, we have that available to you. It is anonymous. It's run by a third party. I can't tell who's calling or who's inputting. So I think it's just an awareness issue, possibly, but maybe nothing's going on. I don't know.
Just curious, I commend you for looking at the enterprise risk management. Do we have a risk management committee, or what's the structure today?
We do not have a risk management committee. It's more falls into the president's cabinet. So that's kind of been the structure since I've been here.
It's a good question. That's a question I asked when I arrived, because it's pretty used to having one of those. And so the hope is, and I think that we're going to do this next year, begin a process of looking at, within this set of broad categories, green, yellow, red, right. And where are we? And so I think that getting a sense of the place, we've got some challenges around improvement, retention, enrollment, and revenue, but there are other things out there, and sometimes the risk is a risk of doing nothing. And so we're going to formalize that next year.
Because when I think about, we just went through the audit report, and within that there are various financial risk controls that are set up. Most companies, whether it's public or private, don't do the operational risk, which is actually probably even greater. And so when you were talking about it, when I think about all the things that the president of yours has to deal with from his perspective, just making sure that you've got some process or procedures in place of how this is very important. I'm glad you're starting chat sessions, but having a formal process and structure would be critical for us to manage the risk of the university in terms of how we manage things.
And we do have prior to just that part, we do have a risk assessment that we do on an annual basis, which is part survey, part interviews face-to-face with the executive team. So they're able to speak about what their issues are in their area, what they know about the industry as a whole, what's emerging. And we all document that in a risk universe and use that to create the audit plan. So that's the
when
process.
When you do that, is it just something that you manage, or where's
it?
It is.
The audit plan is then prepared on a periodic basis. It's okay. Here's my internal audit plan that we intend to go forward with, and we have it in writing that comes to us. If we don't say go do this instead of that, she gives us that plan, and I guess you got a procedure for that.
Is there a follow-up? So there's really no follow-up that after you've done all that, sort of, here's what my priorities are for this year, here's what I did or what I found. There's no reporting back. Do you come back with a year-end report?
About the risk universe, or?
Yeah.
I
know you're doing I assume on the audit plan. But I was just saying that if she identifies the risk through an assessment, and she comes in and says, here's the things we've identified, does it ever come back to say, this is how we manage it and we're better, versus what happens?
I don't want to speak to Jennifer, but what we get, George, is Well, for example, I've got the change fund analysis here, and she will go in there and an executive summary will identify high, medium, and low risk, and then there'll be recommendations as it goes in, and then she'll come in and she'll say, okay, here's where we are in the process. We've gone to talk to that department head, we've done this, we've done that, they're in the process of doing it, they're not in the process of doing it, or whatever it may be, but I think I tend to agree with George, doing it more at the risk level analysis.
And I like what the president is suggesting. Typically, it is a red light process. So it's easier to review, and you
what we did based on this.
I like the fact you're doing an assessment, that's a positive. But it's sort of like if we're not sending it out to the right people and getting the right people engaged in it and coming back and reporting to the board. One of the things that all boards are going to have to deal with is our responsibility to this management.
Sure.
And what happens is today that is you tell us there's a problem, we hope you've dealt with it. Great. And then we think we've resolved, but ultimately we're going to have to do a better job of it. Both financial and operational risk.
And I also think that it's a management tool. It's a strategic tool. And so while doing risk management at the tactical level is important for those day-to-day operations, which is important from a management strategy perspective is longer term, what's the risk in the external environment and how are we being proactive and ahead of the curve on that instead of waiting until it's appears at the tactical level. So I agree.
One of the recommendations that George is making and Ann had suggested, if we're going to have this fraud awareness, per se, say at the retreat, it might be also a good time to discuss how the administration would address it, maybe if we would talk about that at that time. That might be something we want to put on that agenda and have a specific plan for the retreat, because I think his idea is right.
Can we cover it? Just to find it, what we would do is, I know we talked about the fraud, but the agenda item would be risk management.
Right.
Okay, good. I didn't want to narrow it down to just the fraud issue.
Well, it's a broad issue that identifies the risk and then how you manage it. Yeah, I agree. It's kind of a small deal. Anything else? I'm David.
We're about finished. I just want to mention for the newer members, we're really just approaching, I think, the fourth year that this has been established. And Jennifer came from on staff, and she's been a real competent. She's done a very good job getting this underway. I think we're way ahead of some of the other universities that may have had this set up earlier from what I've heard a couple of times. So I think you and your staff are doing a great job. Going to come along, I think, pretty well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, David.
Joe, can I say something? Sometimes I don't know if it's appropriate. Sometimes I have all these thoughts in my brain. I'm not sure if it's appropriate, but you all have the ability to be able to shoot like an in-service out to every employee via email on campus. And the reason I was asking is that fraud management, sometimes at the company can do that. If we see something, or we're getting ready for survey, because we contract with skilled nursing facilities, we shoot out massive email to all our employees saying, hey, reminder, this is how you make sure your documentation, everything, all your I's are dotted, your T's are crossed. We also have one about hostile work environment, sexual harassment, things like that, that we shoot out periodically. They're mandatory. They have to go in. There's a crazy little test. Some of these tests are kind of funny because I take them, as all the employees do. And they'll ask crazy questions because they want to make sure. It's much like the driving test because I'm very familiar with the driving test. And so when they ask, they make sure in like page 5 they'll have a question and they'll answer it. But they make sure that every employee, so that you at least have it documented, that every employee has seen it because they finish it, complete it, the report comes back to you. Do you all have that ability to do that?
You're talking about training and you do that on an annual basis or?
Whenever. But we also do it if we feel like there's something that needs a tweak or that we need to remind people, we shoot it back out as then and make them mandatory.
Internal audit doesn't do that. That's something that we can think about doing, or is that more of a management to manage the risks? Internal audit's not allowed to per our standards to manage risks, so if that's kind of what we're talking about, that would be more of...
And that's sometimes where, Jennifer, I don't know where to bring up a thought or a process where it would actually fit in.
And I think the place is through human resource management. So if you think about all the other trainings that we do and how we provide information, that's the place. That's the function that we'd use to get that up. I think it's a good idea. Adding to the list of the policies that we're educating folks on, make sure they know it's there.
Do a PowerPoint or a presentation shootout as how we do our
resources. John?
At first I wrote down a couple of notes
to make a couple of compliments, but I think this is appropriate at this time for number one to say that the true sign of leadership is someone who begins to lay these processes out in advance. And I want to compliment David and also Freddie that were on the forefront of developing this department, and also that we had the right person in that role. But now we're at a stage, and that's a compliment that I want to sincerely say for the public and for the faculty and the staff, because auditing is not about I gotcha. Auditing is about process improvements. And if we can't decide as a community that we're going to allow these things to help us then and live in fear all the time, then we're in bad shape. George's point, we've got to do risk management. Well, what's that going to do? It's going to create a better environment for all of us to live. But I would like to make a comment. I think we should, number one, consider beefing up this department for the exact reasons that both of our regents have mentioned, and that is training and risk management. And I don't think that we should apologize that we're spending money in an area that is going to make us all in a better place. But thank you again, David and Freddie, for taking foresight to say this is an area that we needed attention in 4 years ago. They did, and we followed through on that. But I do think it's important for us all to remember exactly when it took place, and at the same time, these new advancements that we've got to add to that. So thank you very much, and thank you all.
Thank you.
I do appreciate you saying that we're not out to get you, because we're not. And that's for me to say publicly, we're not here to do that. We're here to help and add value. And so that's our passion, and that's exactly what we want to do. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank you for those comments, too. Internal audit is two people. $400 million budget. You know, 2,000-3,000 employees. So it can't be one office that's held accountable. One of the things that we talked about just this week is that we have a lot of policies and procedures, and have worked hard to make sure that they're clear and meet our needs. But it doesn't do any good if no one reads them or gets reminded what the proper procedures are. You hire a new employee, and that employee goes across the hall and says, "How do you do this?" And perhaps then the person across the hall has been doing this for 10 to 12 years and may not be doing it correctly. So we've talked about training. What do we do about training, retraining, without it being onerous? There's online tools that will help, but there's so many things about our operations. You made some of our sexual harassment, the procurement part, totally different kind of training. But how do we deal with 2,000 employees that need to understand the risk and the what to do? Even we've also talked about what do? You think something doesn't smell right? But you also go, well, you know, that's the way it's always been done. We need, with only two people in internal audit, we need people to be able to feel comfortable in saying, I may not know what I'm talking about. It just something about it. My little voice says that this makes something. Yet. So we are making it, Mr. Porter, you're right, and Mr. Ridley, we're making a lot of progress in this area, but Jennifer comes back and normally says, where are we on the learning curve, the growing curve, and I think we're still, I don't know if we've gotten out of infancy and toddlerhood yet. We've gotten a little further.
Oh, yeah.
Good. I don't want to underestimate what we've accomplished. Thank you.
Okay. Nothing further on the that information item. We'll move to the next, which I have is outstanding student accounts and collection procedures.
Ladies, you just wait. I'm going to turn this presentation over to Sharon Potter. She's Director of Strategic and Enrollment Management and Retention Support. Belinda Higginbotham is an outstanding bursar. But I'm letting them do the presentation because they're the experts. But I've been sitting here thinking about why we put this on the agenda. When you think about, we are all about retention. What are we going to do? This is one component of student retention that's very important, where they understand the billing and whether we allow them to re-enroll and how they understand their financial obligation. So I was sitting there thinking about what happens when you don't pay your utility bill.
Well, you get a notice, maybe, and what if you didn't check your mailbox? Or what if you have already signed up for paperless billing and you didn't check your email? So you come home one day and the power's turned off, and you're like, you know, maybe you didn't do an ACH and paid your bill. So there's a financial responsibility. The utility company probably tried to remind you that you owe money, but the ultimate responsibility rests with the consumer, and there's a consequence for your actions. Now, what you're going to hear about is proactive, reactive, and we're dealing with students, very young people that may have not had this type of responsibility before. So we have a fiduciary responsibility, but so do the students. And we're educating them, and we're also trying across financial affairs, enrollment management, across the institution to be able to address issues related to students' progression and how does the student billing and paying for their fees impact their ability to progress here. So, Lane.
Every bit of it. That was slides 1 through 4, but that's okay. I'm Sharon Hunter, for those of you who haven't met me, and I am honored, privileged, and terrified that Ms. Mead let me join this committee. I'm usually on our help with the Academic Affairs Committee. We literally are trying to close the gap. WKU is an institution of opportunity. How do we maintain that, and how do we help our students to persist and to reach their degree goals? Striking the right balance. Ms. Mead just alluded to this. Who bears the primary responsibility? Is it WKU training the students, teaching them about being cognizant that there's a cost to go to college? Is it WKU that we have to do more outreach? We take more of a parental role. I think it's somewhere in the middle. And not to repeat Ms. Mead's wonderful introduction, it's all about beginning the conversation. When a student is recruited, admissions begins that conversation. They provide the students with information about the cost of attendance, working in conjunction with student financial assistance. I got it right. I keep saying services. To enable them to know the true cost of attendance. We are beefing up that process. We are providing additional information at orientation. We're talking to the parents as well as the students so that we can give them a complete picture. Identifying gaps, and you all heard last year from Cindy Burnett, our director in student financial assistance, about that gap, making sure that the families are aware of that gap because that's something they're going to need to address on an ongoing basis. Communication with students prior to classes, the cost of attendance, financing college sessions at orientation, emails to students. Financial aid and the bursar's office have a robust communications flow that Belinda's going to talk to you a little bit about in the next slide. But it's making sure that we remind them, we tell them verbally, and then we remind them again, both in emails and hard copies. Now, the first 2 weeks of the semester, this is day 5 of the semester, and we start to look at data. IT has been a wonderful partner with us. And we look at things such as, did a student log on to the network? Have they logged on to Blackboard, our learning management system, where our course materials are located? Did they have a meal card swipe? Have they been to the Preston Center? Has a faculty member dropped a student for non-attendance because they weren't in class? We take all of that information together. We put it in our crystal ball. We talk to housing. We talk to everyone on campus. I don't want to say it takes a village. It takes a family because it really is a proactive, student-friendly process. We do everything we possibly can to make sure that if a student is not here, they don't continue to get bills, we allow them to drop their courses so that we provide course seats for students who are actually here. So it's very much a juggling act. We have done, Bob Skipper has been one of our wonderful people who does a voice recording, and we send that out to students. I saw your smile. Skipper, Bob is immensely popular. And the students reacted on social media saying, oh, I got a call from Skipper, Bob. And we saw a rise in registrations. So the reminders, we have to meet them where they are. So we're trying to be flexible. The other thing we do is we have a two-week checkup, an idea I stole shamelessly from Dr. Sales. And we have instructors for entering students. We send them a survey. We ask them how they're doing. Are you still positive about graduating? Have you bought your books? What are your instructors' names? Do you intend to stay at WKU? 5 questions. Takes them about 90 seconds on their phone. And we have actionable data 2 weeks into the semester. If they're having financial difficulties, they can say they need help, and we're there. So that is what's happening on one side. And now Belinda is going to tell you what is happening simultaneously.
Thanks, Sharon. As you can gather, our offices work very, very closely together. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the billing and collection processes for a fall semester. Beginning August 1st, the Office of the Bursar begins sending monthly billing statements with a mid-month due date. The bills will reflect the students' charges for tuition fees, meals, housing, bookstore charges, parking permits, anything that's charged to their student account. Scholarships and financial aid that have been awarded will also be reflected on that bill in order for the students and the families to know what their responsibility is. Bills are sent electronically to the student's WKU email address. Students refer to that as their topper email, as well as any other billing email address the student has designated. And we strongly encourage our students to add a billing email address, and that way we can send it to the payer of that bill in addition to the student, because we know how difficult it is sometimes for students to send those on to their parents. So we take that responsibility with the students, and we communicate that heavily with them. And while the bill is a snapshot in time of their bill at that moment, students can get on TopNet at any point in time to see that account summary, see if anything new has been added, any additional financial aid has been posted, etc. So as we're going through, students who fail to pay their bill by the due date may be assessed a late payment fee, and a financial aid obligation hold or a financial obligation hold will be placed on the accounts that have not been resolved after our September due date. And what this hold means is that it prohibits their future registration activity and the receipt of official transcripts. Students are notified when these holds are placed on their account through several mechanisms. We use email notification, urgent messages on Blackboard, and on TopNet. So this billing timeline shows a very high-level overview of our continued billing process and outreach with students throughout the semester. And it's not just a matter of sending bills and getting payments in. It really is a balance and with an emphasis on student accountability and responsibility, while also being as student-friendly as we can possibly be. But what is not reflected on this timeline are the countless one-on-one interactions that we have with students on a daily basis. And this outreach is not done in a vacuum. In addition to all of the touch points from the bursar's office, as Sharon discussed previously, multiple other areas are involved with this, such as student financial assistance, housing and residence life, our international office, other areas with enrollment management. They all assist with contacting students and resolving those balances throughout the semester. So if all of those efforts throughout the semester, we just don't get those accounts paid and they remain unpaid following the completion of the semester, those unpaid accounts are placed into our internal pre-collect process. And during the pre-collect process, our office works with students to establish payment agreements and resolve as many accounts as possible. And we're still working with other offices even past the end of the semester. Students are advised during that process that if they don't respond and they don't make payment arrangements with our office,
their account could be placed with the Kentucky Department of Revenue and reported to national credit bureaus. If that occurs and the student's account is written off from our student information system into our collection system, the student is then sent a final demand letter, and that notifies them that their account will be referred to the Kentucky Department of Revenue if they don't contact us within 21 days. As we're telling students about the DOR, we let them know what that means. And what that can mean is wage garnishments, bank levies, liens, tax refund seizures, and other collection actions. So we are really trying to work with students to not have that happen. But we do have that process in place for those accounts that remain unpaid. The Department of Revenue does add collection penalties to those accounts, and WKU does not pay DOR for any of that service. It is provided. So the next couple of slides are going to show some comparative information to national averages to give you an idea where WKU stands in these processes. So although we have experienced some increases in outstanding receivables and related bad debt, the amount we remain consistent with or below national averages. So according to the 2017 Student Financial Services Benchmarking Report, and it's compiled by the National Association of College and University Business Officers, known as NACUBO, the outstanding receivables as a percentage of the total dollar amount invoiced at the end of fiscal year 16 was 3.4% nationally. As you can see, WKU is 2.97, and I'm happy to report for fall 17, we are below that at 2.45. This chart is going to show information about the write-off, and you can see that that has increased as well. And if there are questions, I'll be happy to respond to those.
No, we need to applaud you. That's marvelous.
Thank you very much.
Well, we try to clarify that. I mean, it's marvelous that you're managing it. It's not marvelous that the write-up is going on. That's a problem that I hope at some point in time we, as a board, talk about how we can address that. In addition, even doing it on the front end as we're making decisions, I'm thrilled with everything you're saying, but you are really managing
it's half. Great. It's half the national average.
Yeah, she's doing a great job managing
that data point. That a change in the policy,
There was a policy change.
Yes.
Before, in the prior years, we had a drop for non-payment, and that was an extremely odious manual process. Financial aid was reviewing every student to see if there was anything that they could do for them multiple times. The bursar's office was doing the same thing. We were working with them in enrollment management. And if we dropped, and I'm the number 740 sticks in my head, and I think I'm pretty close for the last drop, we ended up reinstating 50% of those students. Unfortunately, we had to register that 50% back into courses. We had to hope that the courses that they had on their schedule were still available. So we thought that a better use of our time and a better assistance to the students was to not do that drop, but to work with those students and provide them with additional time during the semester. Previously, we dropped on the
first of October.
Instead of that, we've got from October to the end of the fall semester for students and their families to come up with the remaining balance.
So one of the challenges with this, though, so you will see this reflected in retention data. If you don't draw people in advance of the 28-day number or whatever the official number is, you artificially inflate the enrollment numbers for the fall, and so your retention data looks worse in the following semester. And so policy changes and levers that you pull one place show up in a different place, and so this is something that we have to talk about. I think it is not just a tactical question. It's a question around accuracy of numbers. What we have now are 50% of that number showing up in our fall registration numbers.
that aren't actually here. And so that 50% will make our retention number go down, and you're going to see in the future, and you're going to see that in some of the numbers reported later in the session. It also artificially inflates the collection number because were these folks ever here? And so I want to be careful.
So I'm glad you said it because, again, when I think about write-offs, it was great to read this. I'm glad that we're doing it again. I'm very excited about it. But it just, there are pieces to this on the front end. There are pieces on the back end that I was concerned with reading that I didn't. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to learn that. But I'm glad we're going to address it. And we are being glad about this.
And we are looking at this process every single semester. We meet. We continue to refine it. We have made changes on the fly with 2 weeks' notice to totally change the story. The drop to non-drop was done in 2 working weeks. And how they did it, how they got everything done, I'm not sure, but we completely changed our business processes, and no one outside of poor Cindy and Belinda and her staff and financial aid staff were probably aware of the amount of work it did.
No, thank you.
Did it actually help the retention, though? Because I'm reading this, and the change in the policy was for the purpose of increasing retention of students by not dropping them. Did we? I know the stats might be artificially deflated, but it had a positive effect on retention.
If we look, we looked at fall of 17 students who were retained to spring. And there is an academic component to this, of course, but students with a 3.0 or better GPA who had a term balance, we retained them at a 70.5% rate. On the other side, speaking to what the president had to say, the students who were less prepared with less than a 3.0 who had a balance, we retained those at a 23.7%. So there's academic preparedness. Retention is not a flat target. It's a ball.
Yep.
And we have to hit it on all the sides that we can identify. So the things that you're going to hear about in just a few minutes from academic advising retention and what they're doing to assist that, we're starting to see some changes. The change in the economy, the changes in new and improved scholarship programs at the state level. There was a quote in the New York Times on the 9th, and it said that for enrollment managers, this has never been a more tenuous time. Every student we gain in one sector is a student you take from another. So we... the economics of the situation, we are still a wonderful deal and a great opportunity for students. But we're going to keep looking at this. We will never stop kicking the tires. Every time we can think of a good idea, thank goodness we've got upper-level management support, and they allow us to go in there and be aggressive and see what we can do to both keep us fiscally responsible and accountable and to assist every student we can.
You know, and I was going to make the same comment, ask the same question to Jason did, you know, in terms of there are positives and negatives in this. And in all my conversations with the president, I believe that this is the approach he takes, and this is the right approach. What's the principles that we're going to offer them? Okay. And it's really thinking about what will be our guiding principles. And what I'm hearing and what I see is our first guiding principle, do we want a university that is to educate young people and students, and we have to keep it there. And we will make decisions. Some will be good, some will be bad, but as long as we're keeping it to the benefit of the students, I feel good about that, because that's what my guiding principles are. And I think that's what you're trying to do. And I'm glad that you recognize that this is a ball, and we have to look at it from all angles, because you know the question that I wanted to ask that you just addressed for Jason, which was, if I'm at a 3.0 because I'm prepared for college, okay, there's a lot of things going in my favor that's going to make sure I'm back here. If I'm below that, there are not a lot of things in my favor that I'm going to come back, or I'm going to make it, or I'm even going to stay through the full semester. And we have to do better at determining who that is, because the thing I don't want to see us do is that you let me in and thank you for the opportunity. I don't make it, and you send me back worse off than I was when I came, when I go back to my community. That's the worst thing. So I know your value system. I know that, but we should be making sure that when we set our guiding principles about this, I want to help every student that we can, but we can't help every student. And I sure do not want to make a student worse off because they came here and tried. That is something that we really need to be thinking about.
And a follow-up to Regent Nichols' comment. So I was wondering how it is that you communicate the cost of attendance. Because I know that especially among first-generation students, a lot of times they don't have parents to look to for guidance about like the four-year total cost. And most of the time when we're calculating that four-year tuition, or I guess the total cost of attendance with fees and everything, we're looking to just one set year. So are you adjusting for like the increases over 4 years, and how are you discussing that with parents? Because a lot of times they can plan for that first year based on what's already online and what we've been viewed, but what we have viewed, but not for the whole package.
I think that's an excellent question in orientation. Do you want to talk about what you sure. do in orientation?
We've seen that same problem because for so long, the challenging, especially with us having a university that has such a high need population, is that shortfall and that gap. And I've shared some alarming numbers a few meetings back. But one of the things that we've seen when we are doing these massive efforts, and we do, it is a hands touch, trying to do everything we can, but sometimes we feel like we're just applying a Band-Aid. And so we do try to look at not just fixing the immediate problem, but planning for a four-year problem. The problem that we run into is engaging students and taking that responsibility and parents and being aware of that this is a challenge for them and something that we're going to do. One thing that we've done this past year, we haven't got to see the fruits of that yet, but we partnered with the business college and we added in our orientation sessions, we are encouraging students and parents to sign on and partner with us and do a partnership with them for one-on-one advising where we can look at and we're sharing information with them on the students funding outlook for the current semester. We're working with those students. What can we do short term? But then what is your parent's financial situation? What can we do over a four-year period? So we're really trying to get them to thinking beyond campus looks great, it's where I want to be, but there is a cost tied to it. What is realistic? What are those resources that are available to me? What is that shortfall, and what is my four-year plan? We likewise struggle with the students that are here for one semester. They get Pell, they get full student loans, they don't do well academically, and they leave here, you know, that 20-something percent that leaves here with debt, and they're further in debt, no further with their college education. So it's a continued challenge, but that is something that we're trying to get to year one, but let's come up with a four-year plan. And it may be that we make some hard decisions as students that maybe this summer, you know, I've got to work and I've got to save and I'm going to have enough to take care of my shortfall this next year so that's not as much a struggle. So that's one thing that we're doing to try to help them see a four-year cost plan versus just one year.
Let me make a comment. I think that got a little bit into the academic committee report or meeting, which is fine. And again, I apologize. We've got a marathon meeting today. Before we take a quick break, I'm going to let you finish up first. Let me just say something what George is thinking. You know, there's a best-selling book out right now called Principles. And it talks about how important culture is. And I think this discussion today is great. And we need to take as much time as it requires. We're going to have some lunch coming in anticipation of this day dragging on a bit, so everybody hold on. But within this new culture, they talk about radical truth, radical transparency, creating what's called an idea meritocracy. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And with Dr. Pagani's leadership, I think we're on track to do some of those things. So if Regent Johnson is willing, we'll let them finish their report, and then we're going to take a short break.
You had something, though. Did you want to go ahead, Sharon? Go ahead.
I just said we have two slides, so we're...
Okay, well, we'll be quick. Okay, the next slide talks about the Department of Revenue, and just wanted to provide you some information on what a great job they have been doing to help us get those things collected, and that has really helped us offset any kind of university bad debt expense we have, and so we are very, very pleased with the results that we have from the Department of Revenue.
And I'll turn it back to Sharon.
Okay, and I'll be done in 45 seconds, Julia. The things that we're doing, next steps. Richard Nichols talked about identification of students proactively who are at risk. What type of programs can we build to help them meet that gap before it gets into a, oh my gosh, I'm anxious about this outstanding balance. Cindy just talked about the and student financial assistance. That's my error. The targeted financial aid information, Cindy talked about again, the added 2-week assessment. To early alert so students can alert us to the issues that they're having. And any new idea that you come up with, the campus community has really gone across divisional lines on this one. This is a perfect example of us using all of the brain power that we have available at the institution. No idea is too outlandish, and I think that we will continue to improve the process. And thank you very much.
You had one comment.
I did. Thank you, Richard Johnson. One of the things we've been talking about the entirety of the year is that we should not admit any student who doesn't have a reasonable chance of graduating from this institution. And reasonable chance does not just take into account academic performance and preparation, but it also takes into account the ability to afford what we're doing and what they're participating in. So if we have to be clear, more direct, and more intentional about helping families and students understand cost of attendance and what their portion of that is. I'm more concerned about the number of students who enroll and graduate than I am about the total number of students we enroll. And so as we shift to a performance funding system, our focus should shift to students who can come, study, and graduate in 4 years, and less focus on the total number of enrollees we have in any given semester. And that's the only comment I had. Thank you.
We have only one item left, but we're going to take a break now. It's okay with everybody for 10 minutes.
It's 10:41. We're going to come back at 10:47. 6 minutes. Okay. Try a second to get back in their seats. Pick up where we left off.
Last call, Ruth.
I made it on time.
Yeah, can you go out and come back here?
It's right, so I can breathe that fresh air.
Please.
That's right. It made my entrance. Did you notice my boots match my jacket? And my jacket and boots match my lipstick? Because you all know.
Okay. Here's Regent Ridley. We're ready to go.
We're waiting for.
All we had to wait on you instead of me.
I'm talking to the staff of the housing.
On second. It's gone.
Just wait for
you. Got a quorum. I'm getting a lot of criticism for being windy. I don't normally do this, do that. I make a better entrance.
But we barely had a quorum. Okay, we'll get going here. The last item. Okay, this is the last information item, resource allocation management and planning. Budget model.
Yes, we received some emails. I'm sure you're aware that we have kicked off a process that we'll try to get the afternoon grant. To keep it short, sometimes you hear it already referred to as a new budget model. All I want to say is it's much more than a budget model. It's an entire resources allocation strategy. It addresses management decisions at a more decentralized level. The key component is that it must re-incentivize and reward performance. So this process will happen over the next 6 months, and if the committee would like and find it beneficial, we can have Huron consultants come do a budget presentation, model presentation to you at your April. Is that a good idea?
That's a good thing. Yeah. Because they're just now getting started.
That's right.
We're really not having things.
Next week we have our first steering committee meeting, and they're analyzing data, and they're scheduling individual meetings. What's important for the campus to know about this is there's going to be numerous opportunities for input and feedback. So this is a very important initiative.
Bonnie,
you have anything else you want to say about that one?
It's important for us to make sure our dollars flow to where we're performing, and that we have those dollars allocated in a way that folks who use them understand what's coming. This empowers leadership across the enterprise and helps folks know that if I do A, then I'll receive B. And we'll be able to plan in a way that shifts resources and makes us more nimble fiscally. And allows all of those decisions to be connected to our performance funding model and make clear for folks both where revenue comes into the institution and what support functions exist and how those are funded too. So it adds a level of clarity and nimbleness to the way university works and empowers deans and departmental leadership as well.
How is the new strategic plan going to be taken into account for here on, considering it's not done? Not to a point yet where it's even white paper.
So parallel processes are not unusual. They're actually pretty typical as universities go through strategic planning and budgeting. What will happen is the budget model process will free up a pool of funds to be reallocated toward a new strategic plan. And so instead of waiting for the planning process and doing this serially, having the parallel process will mean that as soon as we have the strategic plan finished and approved, we also will have a budget model in place that begins to shift resources toward the things that emerge from the planning process. And so they're pretty comfortable and actually would prefer to do it this way than to wait until the end of a more academic planning process.
Very, very high level in terms of the question I'm asking, but the answer is, you said about 6 months we'll probably really start seeing something that's coming from the kickoff soon, give us something. What's your time frame of when you're hoping they would be finished or having something that you can
run? So the model will run parallel systems next year. So they'll have a new budget model finished within the next 6 months that we're ready to look at, approve, and put into place. We'll run that budget model and our current budget model for a year so folks can watch what happens as funds flow through a new model allocation process. And then for fiscal year 20, we would flip the switch and move to the new model.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, Anne. I mean it this time. Thank you.
I'm gone now.
Okay.
Thank you.
That, Philip, concludes our Finance and Budget Committee meeting.
Very good. Thank you. And I think those were excellent reports. The discussions were appropriate and good. And before we move to the Academic Affairs Committee, let me again compliment our president on his emphasis in getting these parallel projects going. Let me also brag on Ann, particularly Regent Johnson, who as they've been down in the weeds and the details and really doing great work with our budget council. And I don't think we can overstate how important those are to our future success and ability to meet our mission. So, all of us, thank you.
Lord,
yes. All right.